My name is Mole Fetsile, and this is the second lecture on the role of the church in the struggle against apartheid in terms of trying to look at how we got to where we are. And the purpose is to highlight very important stands or steps taken by the churches or Christian communities and see. Yesterday I discussed mainly what are the challenges, the present challenges, what is the church doing or expected to do today and building the future. And the purpose now is to say, how did things get to where they are? We should start by being very honest with history. And in being honest with history, we should start by saying that the church's role in the struggle against apartheid is not an impressive story. It is a story that actually should be embarrassing to us. Because the church, for most of its life in South Africa, has been an active supporter and a beneficiary of the apartheid rules. In those instances where the church took a stand or had to take a stand against apartheid, it was in most instances forced or dragged to do that. We should be very cautious, therefore, of suddenly praising the churches in South Africa or Christians and say how brave and how exemplary they are. Anything along that is a new phenomenon. It's not an old thing. This is very important, especially at a time when many people in South Africa today wants to take credit for the changes that are happening. And part of that credit, even the church wants to say, we also did something. It's important to set the record straight and say, yes, you did something, but not the extent to which you want recognition. And the second thing is that in talking about the role of the church in the struggle against apartheid, we are focusing mainly on, in other words, in blaming the church's role in the struggle against apartheid. We should be aware that we are not focusing our blame mainly on the churches in South Africa, but actually that blame extends also to Christian communities outside South Africa, especially to Christian communities in Western world. And this is the role they played in the support they lended to their partner churches in South Africa, who they knew that this is the stand they were taking, but they continued to give that stand. And you will see that it was only in the middle of the 1980s that the Christian communities in the outside South Africa, and especially in Europe and America, began to do what I call to redeem their past mistakes. Therefore, we're going to look, and I'm going to ask you at the end whether, with the picture that I'm giving, do you think that the church has redeemed its tarnished image, or do you think that more still needs to be done? Because I'm going to give a balanced picture of where the church erred and where it was very brave. But in general, I want you to make a judgment. And I would say personally, the church still has a chance to prove itself. It's not yet late. The other thing about talking about the role of the church in South Africa is that in most cases there is a confusion between what the churches did and what individual Christians did as people of faith. You can say a lot, for example, about the Dutch Reformed Church, which is the church of the Afrikaner, white Afrikaner in South Africa. And you can say something about individual Dutch Reformed ministers who acted against their churches. So the church may meet in a synod or at an assembly and take specific resolutions, and one minister may act against those resolutions and go and marry an interracial couple. And that is the difference between the church and Christians. Welcome. Historically, the church in South Africa started as a church for immigrants. What happened is that when the ships were going to India and stopping on at the Cape, in that ship there was a dominier, according to the Dutch word for pastor, a dominier for the crew. And when they established a halfway station there, immediately there was a chapel for these people to pray. So it was mainly what we call an immigrant or a settler church. But very soon it did mission work amongst the natives. And then we had on the one hand a church for immigrants whose pastor was part of the crew. Like there might have been a doctor or a nurse for the crew. And then very slowly then there was another church which existed side by side to that, which was what you call a mission church, or the church for the natives. In most instances, that's where the segregation started, that what was happening in the immigrants' church was not necessarily what was happening. And there was no law. It was simply that something that happened automatically. The first segregation started with the English churches, long before the Afrikaners came into power. And when the Afrikaners came into power in 1948, it was mainly through the support of many Christians in South Africa. And after that election, the general teaching about churches in South Africa was that don't get involved in politics. And from there we started having a system that we call apartheid, which basically is a theological justification of segregation, which is based on the teaching that it is the law of nature that species which are different should not mix. And so out of that law of nature, it was used to say that it is by God's design that there should be black people and there should be white people. And because it is by God's design, it is also by God's design that there should be apartheid. And many highly educated theologians believed and taught and defended the policy of apartheid. And you should realize that an interesting thing about South African politics is that in America, virtually all politicians goes to politics via law school. In South Africa, all politicians go to politics via seminary. You'd find that 80% of them are trained theologians. I'm not sure you're familiar with the leader of the Conservative Party in South Africa. He's called Dr. Triermeg. He's a doctor in theology. He's a dominion. That is just a phenomenon. It's a different culture. Now, therefore, for all intents and purposes, the church in South Africa had up to at least the 1960s been acquiescing with the status quo, not really seeing a lot of human rights being withdrawn from other people, but not disturbed about that on the whole. It was there was a crushing incident in 1960 when there was what we call the Sharpeville massacre, which was reported internationally. And out of that Sharpeville massacre, close to 69 people were killed by the British police. Out of that incident, for the first time, the churches indicated to the government that they are not happy with what they did. But it was also still a brotherly advice. It was more like somebody who's still your friend. You just say, "I think you overplayed it here." The government never took the protest of the churches seriously, and what resulted is that in 1968 the churches decided for the first time to write an open letter to the Prime Minister, which is called the Message of the People. And the Prime Minister response to that message of the people was unbelievable. He was so furious, accused them of being communists. That was the first time the label communist on churches was used. And many Anglican priests, Episcopalian priests who were in South Africa then working there were deported back to England, because they just seen that they are interfering. Yes.
What churches were involved in this letter?
It was a communical council. It was signed mainly by the South African Council of Churches. So that would say, but the spiritual leadership then was the Methodist and the Anglican Church, which means what we call the English-speaking churches in South Africa. So the other churches were not that much involved. For the first time then, we saw priests being deported out of South Africa. And it was at that time when other people would have, because now you should know that the most of the clergy in South Africa, especially for white churches, were coming from outside. So it was as if the government is not happy with you, it sends you back. And people had expected their churches from outside to protest that, but mostly they did not. They just said to these people, "Why we send you there, and you create problems. You are a troublemaker," as the government was saying. And about that time, the Dutch Reformed Church also withdrew from the World Council of Churches. So we enter the 1970s with a church which realizes that the government really is not a fair government. It is exclusive of people, but it's not fundamentally offended by that. It has a very cordial relationship. The government has functions, it invites the churches attend. The churches install a bishop, they invite the state president, he goes there. It's like a flag and altar relationship. But already apartheid was in full force by 1970s. And the churches was called, and it was mainly termed a liberal institution at that time. The leadership of the churches were people who were not what we call radicals. You should realize that this was the major cause in South Africa for the emergence of black consciousness. When black consciousness emerged among university students under the leadership of Steve Biko, it was in reaction to the role of the churches or the role of liberals in South Africa. It was a feeling that liberals do talk against apartheid, but really they just pay lip service to it. When it comes to push, they say, you must listen to what the government says. An incident which actually sparked the emergence of black consciousness in South Africa was a conference by by Christian students, which was held at a white university, and the government demanded that black students attending that conference must sleep in the township. And over and above that, they must apply for permission to attend that conference in a white university. So the black students met with the white students and said, hey, really this is not fair. We must sit in a conference with you, and at about 8, we must be taken into cars, dropped in the township to sleep, and then the following morning you must come and pick us up. This is not fair. Why don't you guys do something and protest that this is not fair? We want to be with you the whole night. And you know what the white students said? They said, well, we are sorry, our friend. These are the laws of the government. We can't do anything. And the black students left that conference, went to the township, but they never came back. Instead, they went to the township and formed their black organization that very same night. And that was the starting point of what we call black consciousness in South Africa. It was a reaction to the failure by white liberals to take the concerns, because the black students felt that we're dealing with people who are paternalistic to us. Now, the major shift in the history of the church struggle in South Africa happened in 1976. Two things happened. The first one is that Bishop Tutu was elected General Secretary of the South African Council of Churches, the first black person to occupy that leadership position. The second thing is that students were killed in Soweto. School children were killed in Soweto. And the whole world started reading about the what is happening in South Africa. And so the churches not only this time protested to the government, but it also told the whole world about what the government is doing, and the government was not happy. And then what we call a church-state conflict, the relations became very, very strained, and from then onwards, they were heading for collusion. I should mention that in 1968, when the message to the people was written, which I said that the government responded by saying these people are communists. One Afrikaner leader who was part of this writing of the message of the people, we're going to talk about him tomorrow. His name is Beyers Nodi. He responded by forming an organization which was called Christian Institute, which was an organization not for churches but for individual Christians whose conscience tell them that things are not right in the country. And many people joined. Now, after 1976, two things happened. The first one is the student leader I told you about, who formed the Black Consciousness Movement in 1970, when the white students did not accept them, said that they must get permission to sleep in town. He was killed in detention. And when he was killed in detention, the state responded by banning anybody who was protesting the killing of Steve Biko. And then this led also to the Christian Institute formed by Beyers Nodi to be banned in 1977. And he himself, Beyers Nodi, was also banned. By that time, things were really ugly.
Excuse me, but when you say banned, what do you mean?
It was made illegal and a persona non grata, which means you are under so many restrictions. You can't be with people, you can't talk to newspapers, you can't travel outside, you can't don't have a pass, a travel document, you are a restricted person.
So they stay in the country, but they just have no right?
Yeah, it's basically, it's short of being in prison. But you have been checked by the police.
But you're not sent somewhere. You still have some freedom.
Some banning orders do have banishment. Mm-hmm. You get banished to another area. That's what they did with Winnie Mandela. Mm-hmm. When Winnie Mandela was banned in 1977, around the same time, she was banished to a small place somewhere in which I never visited or seen, even in the map of South Africa. Mm-hmm. But then they vary these banning orders.
Mm-hmm. Beyers Nodi was a Dutch Reform Minister?
Yes, yes.
So he stayed in the country?
He stayed in the country, stayed at his home, but he couldn't talk to the press, he couldn't publish, he couldn't he couldn't preach and so on. Well, I'm not sure about preaching, but at least he couldn't write lectures or speak to conferences. That is it. Okay, now, then at that time the confrontation was increasing, and then the major portion of that confrontation was that the churches started calling for sanctions against South Africa. It started to talk to its people, to welcome of churches, Americans, and say, please help us, appeal to your government and companies not to do business in South Africa. And that's when the sanctions thing started, about that time. This thing went on like that. That is the state-church conflict. And at that time, the interesting thing is that immediately the state started to be very hard on the church. The church was changing in unbelievable manner. It was beginning to be the church of the people. It was beginning to be a clarity of what it stands for. It was beginning to start projects to help detainees. It was unpopular with the government, becoming unpopular with the government, and becoming very popular with the people. And at the same time, the international community started to get involved. It supported many of the projects which were run by the churches in South Africa. Virtually 80% of the budget of the South African Council of Churches was coming from overseas, mainly from Germany. But not only did they support, but they also began to use their pressure by pressurizing their people to disinvest as one thing. But also, for example, around 1984, the Dutch Reformed Church was expelled, primarily by pressure from the American Reformed Churches. It was expelled from the World Alliance of Reformed Churches. And then the following year, the German Lutherans or White Lutheran Church in South Africa was expelled from the Lutheran World Federation. And so the pressure was mounting. We are now between 1980 and 1985. And at that time, the state also escalated its pressure. Many people were being killed. By 1984, all schools in Soweto were not functioning. The army was in the township. People were in detention. Christian funerals couldn't be held because the state was saying that these funerals are being turned into political funerals. Basically, it was said that there was a magistrate order. You move from the home straight to the graveyard, you bury the person, you just say one prayer, full stop. You don't have to have a sermon, because then the state was saying these are not sermons, they are political rallies. And to be honest, some of the church services were used as political rallies because there was no other space that people could meet. An interesting thing happened around this time, 1980 and 1985. I'm going to mention two interesting things. Evangelical groups emerged, what you call Pentecostal groups. Highly financed, big conferences that they held, and all conferences were on respect authorities, it's God, and then blacks reconcile and so on. They were preaching reconciliation and the respect of authority. And about that same time, a number of unknown black church leaders started to travel to the USA, bishops and so, to talk about why it's important that American companies must invest in South Africa because people are suffering and so on and so on. There's Bishop Mokwena, Bishop, and all these are, they were spoken as bishops of blacks with 4 million people. And if you ask me where are those people today, I also don't know where they are. They were just people who were just suddenly in the press and the Washington and so on and so on. And then another interesting thing which happened around this time is that a many organizations started emerging. One of them was a human rights society, or International Human Rights Society, which held hearings in Washington about terrorist organizations. And then those hearings were on the ANC and the PAC as terrorist organizations. So it was as if churches were now kind of being used. There was a big struggle. And about the same time, an organization emerged which was a counter to the South African Council of Churches. It was called something like South African Churches Ecumenical Committee. The name was nearly like SACC, but instead of being a council, it was like a committee. And if you ask me who were the leaders of those people, who were they? No, but the only thing is that it had a lot of money. It was publishing glossy magazine and leaflets about how Christians shouldn't get involved in politics. About 1985, when all these things were happening, when the church and the Christians and the Bible was increasingly being used by the government as another hand in what was happening, the theologians came together and published what came to be known as the Kairos Document. In essence, the Kairos Document said that there is an abuse of theology by the state, and so that this must really is not a good thing. The Kairos Document, incidentally, is in the resource room here, and it's a very important historic document in the history of the life of the church in South Africa. Now, after 1985, after the Kairos Document was released, and interestingly enough, the Kairos Document at the end, it said that Christians must said several things. It said that Christians must call for the release of prisoners, especially Mandela, for the unbanning of organizations, and it called on the government to begin to talk with these leaders. And this is exactly what is happening today. But when it was called in 1985, it was as if these people have just said something which is not supposed to be said by anybody. In 1987, the headquarters of the SACC were bombed, were flattened. And the government said that the ANC is responsible for that. And up to today, the docket is still being under investigation. But everybody in South Africa believes, and quite reasonably so, that this was a job carried out by the state itself. In 1988, another document was published, The Road to Damascus. I won't go into details about that. And then the story arrived to where we are, that in 1990, the organizations were unbanned, the leaders were released, Mandela was released, and the church took a background position where it is intervening as a mediator between the violence and the rivalries that goes on within the community presently, including what is happening between the government and the ANC. So it is still playing an important role. The conclusion that I can draw from this is that the South African Christians or church in South Africa has developed a distinct culture and identity of living out what true discipleship means under those circumstances. But most of it didn't just happen. It has its own history. And most of it is thanks to the resistance they received from the state. And the second thing is that one should never ever underestimate the role, the positive role played by the international community or international community of Christians in this struggle against apartheid. They played an important role. Without it, the churches wouldn't have been able to do what they've done so far. Now, I go back to my first earlier question. Do you think that the church has successfully redeemed its past embarrassing support of apartheid, or do you think more still needs to be done?
Well, what's the, today, what's the position? You know, what's the church doing today, right now, next week, next month? I mean, do they feel like it's resolved in the way that it is, or are they still looking for change and trying to better the way it is?
Most of them tie in with what I said yesterday. Most of them just, they appeal to people to reconcile, to forget about the past, to forgive one another. To not bear grudges or revenge. They are basically a voice of moderation within what is the anxiety about the future.
But are they comfortable with the way things are now?
Sometimes things do get out of hand, and sometimes they think that at least the progress has been made. But when violence and massacres happened like it happened a week ago, they definitely are very much concerned. They are happy to say that at least groups there have got their representatives to talk for them, not the church. They are happy not to be on central stage. But they still think that the government is having a strong hand and is sometimes not willing to let go its power. But that is still not the general voice of the whole churches. This will be still a voice of maybe a few individuals within the Christian community.
You know, I'd like a little more clarification about that. When you are speaking of the churches, are you speaking of the South Africa Council of Churches, or whatever yours is called? And who are members of that? Are the Dutch Reformed Churches part of that? Is the German Lutheran Church part of that?
Yeah, well, thank you for that question. I tried to explain when we started that problem of when you speak of the role of the church in South Africa, it's important to also know that it's a complex, it involves sometimes the role of individuals within that church. And actually I was at pain to show that there is sometimes certain individuals even within, say, the Anglican Church are doing is not necessarily representative of the Anglican Church. And that is the nature of it. So I would personally say I don't know whether one can say that in the general way in which churches are, not only in South Africa, but in most cases. But having said that, it has become customary in the history of writing of a South African church history that one refers firstly in general to the ecumenical movement as the church, and then to go into specifics thereafter to say that where does the Dutch Reformed Church or the Anglican community or the Catholic community and so on fall within that. But if we say the church is called for sanctions, we judge by view of the resolutions of the Council of Churches in those years. In most cases, those resolutions were then repeated by individual synods of churches, Presbyterian and so on. You are in a country which has all these denominations, Moravian, Baptist, and so on, it becomes confusing. But then to answer your question as to who are members of the Council of Churches, then they include most of the English churches, or English-speaking churches, and the Lutheran churches. They exclude most of what are called evangelical churches, which is Assemblies of God, Full Gospel of Christ, and the Baptist churches. They are not part of that. And the Dutch Reformed Church is not part because it moved out in the 60s. It was never expanded. It moved out on its own. And now it has tried to come back. But the churches in last year said that they should study their reapplication. Whether does their reapplication mean that the reasons which took them out, they now think that those reasons are wrong? Or in other words, why do they want to come back? And so now the reasons for coming back were not careful, were not clear, because in the conference when they were asked to support their application, they did not say we are coming back either because we think it was a mistake we did in the past. It for them, they say that we are reapplying because this is the new South Africa, things have changed. And people were saying no, we think that you need to address yourself to what is your faith now. Do you believe people are equal? Do you believe scripture says this? And they felt that they cannot as yet say that in terms of the constitutions and the form of life is still in the past. And so then that what people recommended was that let's give them a chance. Let's receive this application and discuss it next year. So basically by saying let's receive it, discuss next year, is that let's give them a chance to go and attend to these issues. Mm-hmm. So it was not
start
really rejected.
Home or church-based studies on it, or?
Yeah.
Well, the other day you did sort of a sketch of populations and the mixed populations and numbers. Can you do that a little bit in terms of church membership or claimed church membership?
Yeah, it's a... The statistics that I have about church membership, I think that for some reason they are very much misleading. They are from by one South African. I studied those statistics just a few days ago on church membership, and from my knowledge, I found that there is something not. I don't agree wholeheartedly with it, but let's take the current population, which I said is 36 million, okay? And then we start by, say, 5.5 are whites.
Are most of the whites of Dutch background? 60%,
okay. 60%, 3 million at DRC, about 2 million would be a mixture of all the English-speaking churches. The majority split equally between Anglican, Methodist, and Catholic.
And the pretty much along the split along the, you know, these two breaks along ethnic origin. Or a country of origin.
Come again.
In other words, the members of the DRC, they're mainly
Dutch,
coming from a Dutch historical perspective.
Yes.
And the 2 million others would be English.
Mainly English, a few French, in terms of the Catholics and so on. But mainly that they're English, Scottish, or in terms of Methodist Presbyterians and others. But then the majority is Anglican and Methodist and Catholic. The other churches, Presbyterian, Congregational, the minority.
Yeah, okay.
Now when you come to the blacks, this is where the game is interesting. We have the number that I came to is about 28 million. Probably could be 27.5. Now, very interesting. About 5 million belong to what you call independent churches. Okay? Now, these are non-establishment churches. They are not, there is no ties with any historical churches. About would say 1.5 would be Catholic
or
Catholic to Anglican, 1.2 Methodist, 1.3 Lutheran, Anglican, Lutheran, right? And then you have maybe about 5 to 8 who are traditionalist, people who really are still practicing the traditional African life, especially in the Northern Transvaal, certain areas in the Western Transvaal, certain areas in the KwaZulu, Zululand area, people who just have not yet become affiliated. And you've got a mixture of other smaller groups in between. The general idea is that as black and white, the largest church is the Dutch Reformed Church, because it has all those whites plus about the 1 million blacks, who also include colors and Indians. So it is the largest community of Christians, the Dutch Reformed Church. And then the next is going to be more the Catholic Church, and then it's followed by the Anglican Church, and it's followed by the Methodist Church. And then after that you get the Lutheran Church, which has a very, very small white community, because mostly all Lutherans who are there are first generation German immigrants. Those third, second generation, most of them joined the Dutch Reformed Church.
The independent churches are not confederated in any way then, they're just a church on
attempts were made to confederate them, but it has always been artificial.
So they each have sort of a charismatic leader or something, and they just
and sometimes it dies after 5 years.
Yeah.
Okay. And maybe a grandson inherits the position from his father, who was charismatic, and the grandson drinks, humanizes, and then the people they lose faith, and then maybe they join another church or something.
But that's still a lot of people in independent churches.
Oh, sure.
The strongest independent church movement.
It's very, very strong.
Does that include the evangelical churches?
Oh, yes. Now the evangelicals doesn't come here. It has its own it has its own numbers, which are not in this. These are mainly because you have Baptists and so on, and mostly of these are mainly. You see, the advantage with these other churches, especially these, is that they did mission work quite very early, and they are now they've got certain missions where they are about 100 years old. Whereas the recent evangelicals are people who have defected from these churches to join the Assemblies of God. Maybe the parents are no longer going to church, and a child at school becomes a member of student Christian movement, and the chaplain of that is a Assemblies of God person, and the church then child then joins and marries, and then he's no longer a Lutheran, but that. So it's a phenomena of a churches of people who join after being disaffected by mainland churches.
And how about non-Christians?
Non-Christians.
Say religiously affiliated non-Christians, like Jews or Muslims or...
You have Jews in the white community who are part of this, but they are the Jewish community is strong in terms of business community, but not in numbers. I don't think they in the total Jewish community over 500,000. I don't think so. And I'm saying that just by, for example, an assessment of whether there are how many synagogues are there. I mean, it's really, really struggling to find one, even in Johannesburg. and the non-practicing whites also would be there, but it would be people who once belonged to this, because even in this number does not mean all of them are really active. You may find that they're just, it's not just maybe 3 million have that reform, but.
And how about Islam? Is there?
Islam is an interesting phenomenon. It's popular mainly among the Indian community. Now, as you know, the population of Indianness, it is at present about 1.5 going to 2 million. And it's split between Hindu Indians, mainly in Devon, and Islamic community, and a few Christian Indians, maybe 200,000 to 300,000 Christian. So within that, it's a minority. And among blacks, my experience in Soweto is that I don't think there are more, the whole of Soweto. Now, Soweto has a population of close to 3 million people. Maybe there are not more than 100 Muslims.
I think that we've gotten away from your basic question, though. What is the church's state now? Have we redeemed ourselves as a church? I mean, if I look back at my history in the church, in the early 70s, I was on the board of the Luther League, and we were kind of instrumental in waking up the church body to say, we need to take our investments out of South Africa, because the people of South Africa are asking us to do this. And the ALC did take the money out. But then it seems like in terms of real action, since then, there hasn't been that much action. But my question is, what should we do? Because I feel like there's so many, it's such a delicate situation that no matter what we do, it seems like almost anything we would do would make it worse.
Goes back to your question of yesterday, what should we do? Yes, I think that I don't agree that it makes things worse. I think it doesn't help. I'm saying that from my personal experience to begin with. I was arrested in South Africa and I was released mainly because of what Christians in America did, including the Holland community, for example. And I know of many other people whose lives were saved or changed simply by that. By the bishops, for example, of the ELCA, all of them jointly in the meeting, writing letters. Each on his letter has to say, we understand there is a person like this who is arrested in South Africa. We as Christians cannot expect you, such a government of which is supposed to uphold the values, to do that. Can we please either take that person to court so that he can stand for what he did or release him? And after 2 years in prison, the government decided to release him. Now, there are many things that the government of South Africa is doing and would not do if it knew that other people of the same culture, Western civilized culture, would be abhorred by knowing that they do that. For example, if you simply say that in America, if there can be a shooting like this, we would be so surprised, we would immediately investigate it, we would immediately do this. We are surprised that you cannot do that. And I can tell you that they say we are going to do it. Because they want to be accepted as a government that they subscribe to acceptable standards and norms. And so it's simply that you should say to them, we take you to your ways. We want to regard you to certain expected levels. unless you say to us you are a dictatorship, you are a totalitarian government, you are what, but we don't take you at that. So don't behave like one, and they definitely try. Now, it doesn't mean that they will, in all earnest, in other words, they will sincerely do that. It will be obviously always a hypocritical maneuver to cover up, but at least they will try to cover up. Maybe one person won't be killed because of that. Maybe another planned massacre won't be carried out because it's not good politics for them. But if, as long as they think they can do that and get away with murder, they will do it tomorrow. And this is where I'm saying that there are certain things which can be done, I don't think they can do any harm.
Well, I went beyond that. Beyond the level of writing a letter or something, there must be something. Must be something that the Western world can do. You think it's economic? You think more sanctions? You think to isolate South Africa? Is that what it's good? Is it has to be even more isolated?
You see, my views on that I've discussed that question in another setting before, and these are my views. You must start from the principle to the strategies. Once you have agreed on the principle, this thing is wrong. In principle, it will continue until somebody can do this. That's the principle, okay? And then the strategies may differ. Sometimes, in strategies, you need to be informed. You need to select. You need to define the objectives and the mechanisms, etc. That is now a how-to job. You need experts. You need somebody to sit with you and say, this is how South African economy operates. This is its weakness. This is its strength. If you hit here. So for example, somebody may say that, forget about sanctions, hit at target spots, it will change. That is a strategic decision. It's not there. Because the principles, you have covered the ground, all of you agreed something must be done. You simply ask somebody who knows something and say, what is it? Then you sit in a strategy session. For example, strategy-wise, you can say, let's hit on computer software for 5 years. Forget about it. Leave other things. Let them continue. But just attack computer software 5 years, you will be surprised about how much it changes. So that is just a strategy session. Now, I say strategies need informed decisions. You need to sit down with people who know some of when they are there and say to them, we want to do this. Or you have, or if South Africans say, for example, help us, you say to them, we want to help you, you have asked us to help you. Let's sit down. These are the things. What if we do this as America, it is as a strategy, they'll get a substitute from Japan. What is the use of doing it? So now that is a strategy. Because sometimes sanctions can cloud issues. And may begin to do something and say, but we are doing something and yet nothing happens, because as a strategy is ill-advised. But in a strategic session, you would select, you would prioritize, you would give a target, you would give and all sorts of things. You can, for example, begin to close certain loopholes, you can begin to encourage other ways of investments, which you know that these other ways of investment will be more economic-wise, will be more, for example, labor-intensive in terms of increase generating more employment of people there. But if you don't do that, if you just make a blanket approach, you can easily even end up hating than helping, because then you are not entering into a strategy decision. For example, certain companies may be happy that they withdraw so that they can get a substitute which is more electronically or oriented. That as a result, they will simply replace the whole factory floor and reinstall different packaging mechanisms which no longer needs black people, so that IBM may withdraw, but then another company emerges in South Africa, which is called the International Systems, ISM or something like that. And then you look at this International Systems Machines, it's basically internet business machines, it's just that it changed the name, and it's IBM, everything IBM. Now you ask yourself, what have we benefited? Nothing. Because this was not a strategy decision.
With the discussion then of the sanctions that were put against South Africa were because of advice from inside South Africa.
Yeah.
Were they not?
They
so
were.
Were they well thought out?
Well, at that time, you see, things were not really, it was a struggle time. People just like were saying things. You read tomorrow, your family has been wiped out. You come to a church meeting, you say, please help. They say, what can we help? Say, stop making those people your friends. I mean, you just say that. Because it was ugly. You see, it was not an academic situation. I mean, I sat in prison, you know, I mean, sat there every day and said, my God, what? How can these people do such a thing? And you think that you would wish the worst can happen on them. You see, but I'm saying that politically, you are more effective if you have cleared the principles first. Now, it looks like, and not unless you clear the principles, somebody may use this other thing, even against your own principles. For example, I see no sense, personally, to have a company disinvest in South Africa in such a way that it sells its rights and everything to the South African government to continue reproducing by license what it had. It actually makes things worse. But this company is being vindictive. It says, oh, you forced me to go out, fine, I'll go out. But it goes out in such a way that it continues making money but is not itself. Now it's because the principle was never agreed here. You see? But once we clear the principle, the other strategies, no problem. But strategies can also mean you go to these companies, you say that, where will you get help? Let's see. If you think that you're going to lose, can you do it in such a way that at least now we know that you can still remain? Okay? The important thing is, do you think it's important for you to help this process of change?
One of the things that sort of goes along with your question of have the churches redeemed themselves, I guess I'm a pretty strong critic, but it kept occurring to me as you're saying that the churches at this point are teaching a lot about, you know, forgiveness and not being revengeful. Are they also dealing with the fact that there is no forgiveness until there's true repentance?
Yeah, I think that you are right. That is part of the problem where we are, which I said, and I did not say powerfully in the last meeting, but maybe this is the opportunity. You see, my belief is that if the church fails to say what is right, but simply wants to say what is politically convenient or popular, tomorrow you may easily have a political situation of radicalism in which the most popular thing to say is that get rid of the oppressors. And I believe that if the church is capable now of being independent and say that to declare this is not justice, then that church will be capable of saying to any political new popular line and say that you don't believe you can dispute in destruction of people. That is injustice again. Because the church is not caught up in saying whatever passes as popular at that point in time. In other words, that church will be capable of having a voice even after liberation. But now the church seems to be unable to move beyond what passes. Because the newspaper editorials seem to toe this particular line, you see the churches also preaching that line, not really saying that, wait a minute, this is not it. And I think that if a black government can emerge with its own ties, whatever, to newspapers and so on, and push a particular popular line, the church should still be held up to its own standards and say, this is not it.
Seems to me we're asking a bigger question here, and that is the connection between government and religion. And I'm struggling with the notion that we can't work what needs to be worked through in South Africa through a moral government made up of moral people who have whatever religion. I'm confused about, I guess, because I don't belong to a church, I'm confused about the necessity for the church to act like a government. It's sort of like it's taking the place of what our government should be doing in our name, in a moral sense, if we are a moral country. You follow that?
Yeah. A short answer to that, so that you don't overextend the taping session. The first thing is that